This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. This is part two of my chat with Tim. Part one is episode 321. In part two, we cover Kangaroo 89, a huge military exercise with the entire Australian army using an area the size of Western Europe. Tim was also part of an exchange program with the British Army, and he describes his experiences there and the advantages and disadvantages between Leopard 1 and the British Challenger 1 tank. Tim also worked with the Bundeswehr, where he had a fascinating encounter with a former East German tank commander. I'm delighted to welcome Tim to our Cold War conversation. In 89, there was a big exercise, Kangaroo 89. Really original with the names of your exercises in Australia.
Oh, yeah. They put a lot of thought into that, yeah.
Yeah, Kangaroo 89 was a whopper. It was basically the entire Australian army was rolled out to fight a Khmerian insurgency that had, you know, decided to disrupt the Australian north. And so we sent a tank squadron up to the Northern Territory, and we operated around the Katherine region up in the top end. But that exercise ran from the east coast of Australia all the way to the west coast, like an exercise area literally as big as Western Europe. And on that exercise, our tanks, we would have done thousands of kilometres, thousands. And like I remember we were in defence of Tyndall RAAF base, you know, the F-18s and the F-111s that we had based up there. And our Khmerian enemy consisted of guys from our Special Air Service, some invited US Special Forces guys, and our parachute battalion, the 3rd Battalion Royal Australian Regiment, and they were re-rolled for that exercise as the Khmerian insurgents, and they kept us on our toes. But once they were identified, I think that the tank regiment performed really well there, because the speed that we could move and bring overwhelming combat power, you know, to a pinned enemy. All of a sudden they'd be trapped in a town because we were roadblocking all around it and then moving in on them. So it was pretty successful. I got one story about that, the SAS. Apparently they were, I heard years later that from a guy that I did a course with, one of our SAS guys, and he said, "Oh, you're a tanky. Were you on Kangaroo 89? I said, "Yeah, I was." And he goes, "You bastards ran over my motorbike." And I said, "What are you talking about?" And he goes, "Well, I was watching you guys in your hide, in your harbour, you know, and I was watching you for a couple of days. And next thing, you all started up and you just roared off. And one of you drove straight over my motorbike, which was all camouflaged by cam nets and stuff. And he goes, "I had to walk for miles to get out of there." He goes, "I thought you were going to run me over." Yeah, and I've got to say, none of us ever saw an SAS surveilling us, so they're pretty good at their skills, those guys. But, yeah, they had to ride off a motorbike because a tank drove over it.
Brilliant. Just describing that exercise area as the size of Western Europe, I'm just thinking that the whole logistics and resupply in an environment like that must be a real challenge. How was that dealt with?
You know, keeping fuel up to the tanks and ammunition is obviously going to be a logistical challenge. So I remember they solved it in a number of ways there. We had our own internal resupply vehicles, the old M548, we called them the Tilly, the track load carrier, based on the M113 chassis, like a pickup truck. And they had the big rubber bladders full of diesel, and they would come to us in all sorts of terrains and environments. And so they would ferry back, fill up at big fuel depots, and then, you know, under escort, they would come to us in the night and refuel. Other ways that I remember on one particular movement near Katherine on the way to the town of Mataranka, about, I don't know how far it is from Katherine, maybe 120 Ks, we had the squadron on a road, and we all filed through a service station, you know, like a petrol station. And yeah. I remember seeing the operator, you know, he's going, how much diesel do you want? And his eyes were nearly popping out of his head. Yeah, we literally drove to a fuel station and filled up and left that place empty.
Wow. So how many gallon could a Leopard take?
You got me with gallons. Yeah, I'm on the metric system. So, yeah, we carried 985 litres of diesel, which would give you about 600-kilometre range on the road. So, you know, it was pretty economical for a tank, you know, only weighed 42 tonnes combat laden. So it had a massive power-to-weight ratio, and that ZF transmission gave it some speed and economy. So, yeah, 985 litres. You know, it was kind of a chargeable offence to ever let your tank run down on fuel. So we used to top up all the time. You know, it wasn't a good feeling to even run one of your fuel tanks down. So we ran with two fuel tanks, a left and a right. And as soon as you saw the red fuel light coming on, we'd switch over to the other one. That was pretty, you know, that was a pretty rare occurrence when you'd emptied one tank. That kept the fuel up to us each night, usually.
I mean, we spoke earlier about Australia and its history of being a expeditionary force. And I think you also mentioned that post-Vietnam, there was much less of an appetite to get involved in other people's wars. But when we were preparing this, you told me about an interesting conversation you had with your commanding officer.
Oh, yeah. Years later, I was part of an exchange program again. I got posted to the British Army, the 1st of the Queen's Dragoon Guards over in Sennelager, Germany. And you know, we were just emerging from that post-Vietnam cringe in the 90s, and you know, there was this hurtful stuff that was going on in the 80s and 90s, where you know the army and particularly the tanks they used to say, oh, you're just koalas, you know, and you're not to be exported or shot at, you know, and so there was this. Yeah, we knew we were pretty skilled up, and we had some good gear, but there was sort of this sense that we were never going to be able to prove ourselves, you know. And yeah, you know, as a young soldier, you just want to get to use your skills, and there was this sense that, you know, we were not going to, because of the post-Vietnam cringe, you know, the. Anyway, the CO at the 1st Queen's Dragoon Guards, he ended up being like in charge of the entire coalition forces or something, as a general, Sir Simon Male. He said to me, he came, called me up to his office one day just to, you know, to let me to see this exchange guy. And he said, oh, I've worked with Australians before and you guys are very professional. And, you know, I felt quite flattered by that. And he said, it's just a shame you're not more involved in the world. And I think he was right, you know. And it wasn't long after that that we started to get back involved in the world, you know. But, yeah, the period during the late Cold War and into the early 1990s, the Australian Army didn't really deploy much. It wasn't until, you know, we sent a battle group over to Somalia in 1993, and then you know, in the post Cold War shenanigans that went on, we sort of signed up for everything, for better or worse. But that posting to Germany, that was an eye opener for me, because it validated everything that I'd been taught. You know, I knew that we were good. But I felt like for the first time in my career, I was actually in the big league, you know, being part of that that British regiment, you know, Challenger 1 regiment.
How did you rate the Leopard 1 versus the Challenger 1?
Yeah, I consider that I was very lucky in my career that I was able to serve on different types. You know, the meat and potatoes of my tank service was on Leopard 1, on Leopard AS1, of course. You know, the vast majority of my time was on that tank. So, forgive me if I've got a bit of a, you know, a...
it's your first love, like, Tim. Yeah, you're always going to...
Exactly. But there's also the difference, I guess, when you think about it, that Challenger 1 was generationally ahead of the Leopard 1 that I served on. So you're kind of comparing apples and oranges in many ways. But I guess Leopard 1, for me, we had a very advanced model of Leopard 1 when we bought it new in the 70s. So it had all the options, if to put it in new car parlance. It was optioned up. So it was incredibly fast, incredibly agile. It was kind of like driving a sports car, you know. And when I compare that to Challenger, you know, Challenger was more like a four-wheel drive or a bus compared to a sports car. Automotively, it was slower to get up to speed, the Challenger. It wasn't as fast. But that being said, it was, you know, another 20 tons heavier almost. So what it lacked in speed and agility, it certainly gained in crew survivability. That was one of the drawbacks of Leopard 1, I think, was it was created at a time when the gun versus armor race was, the Germans had come to the decision at that time that no matter how much armor you put on a tank, gun power was always going to beat it. So they decided that speed and agility was going to be the armor of Leopard 1. So that was that first main battle tank sort of concept that, you know, hit the ground running in the 60s. So by the time we got Leopard 1 in the 70s, the Leopard 1 was, you know, looking pretty well developed. So it had, you know, four-speed forward transmission, two speeds reverse, a theoretical top speed of 62 kilometres an hour. It could get there as quick as any car on the street. In fact, I remember doing road runs on Leopard 1 and pulling out of traffic lights, and cars would be kind of, you could see the drivers' faces. They'd be kind of dumbfounded that you were keeping up with them out of the lights. So it was a very agile tank and manoeuvrable compared to Challenger 1. Leopard 1 had a kind of a half wheel to steer it for the driver. So you drove it very much like a car. The steering was infinitely variable through the first pressure on the wheel, whereas Challenger 1 was steered old school, like with tillers, with sticks, you know.
Yeah, with the levers, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, a very different beast to drive. But I would suggest that automotively, Leopard 1 kind of left Challenger in the shade. Challenger was, although it had a theoretical, you know, horsepower much in excess of Leopard 1, it was still running dead track. I don't know if you've heard that term. Just steel pins like an old bulldozer kind of track, whereas Leopard 1 had live track. It was rubber bushed, so it didn't soak up the engine's horsepower just trying to drive this track around as much. It saved a lot of horsepower. The track assisted itself to get around. And so although Leopard 1 had a 830 brake horsepower, it was only driving 42.5 tonnes, as opposed to Challenger 1 with over 1,000. I forget how many horsepower, up to 1,500 horsepower, I think. It was driving the really ancient old tracks and all that extra tonnage of armour. And not as automotively reliable. We could get an engine transmission. We called it a power pack. You could bring the Leopard armoured recovery vehicle in with its integral crane, old power pack out, new power pack in, 40 minutes, and you're back in the fight. Whereas, you know, I think Challenger had a few challenges like that. Now, that being said, if the Cold War had have gone hot and I had the choice between Challenger 1 and Leopard 1, I strongly believe that I would have rather been on the two-way range with, in Challenger 1 because just because of that crew survivability factor, it had that chobham armour, which was, we felt like they were bulletproof completely. You know, they were very survivable.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more. This was this new ceramic armour that the British had brought, had invented.
Yeah, the British developed this, you know, I still don't know what's in it, but we understand that it's got different layers of metal with spacings in it and layers of ceramic, so it could defeat both kinetic energy and chemical energy rounds. I mean, it was heavy, clearly, because I think Chally won 68 tonnes or thereabout. And with the added side skirt armour, I think it got up to over 70 tonnes, 72 tonnes or something. But, I think I would have preferred to have served on Challenger, to be honest, if the Cold War had have got hot. The Leopard was a generation behind it in survivability. Wet stored ammo, the Challenger has wet stored ammunition and three-part ammunition. So it had the projectile, the charge bag, and the what they called the vent tube, the like the detonator, all stored separately. So you're not going to have, you know, a catastrophic explosion if the armor is penetrated. Whereas Leopard 1, it was all just like a World War II tank stored in a rack as a one-piece ammunition. And if that happens to catch fire, like we've seen imagery of what happens to those sort of vehicles in the Ukraine, they just blow up. So I feel like the Challenger was definitely a harder hitting tank with its 120mm gun and more survivable. So I feel like I would have put up with that automated basket case compared to the Porsche sports car, just because I know me and my crew would have probably come out of it alive.
And would you, because you did some service on Leopard 2, so would you make similar comments in terms of the comparison between Challenger 1 and Leopard 2?
Leopard 2 was probably a little bit of a hybrid. I did that course with the German army, the Bundeswehr, and Leopard 2 was like Leopard 1 automotively. It was fast and agile, 1,500 horsepower, but it had fixed up a few of the problems of Leopard 1 in that it had separately stowed ammunition with blow-off panels. So if the ammunition was hit, these blow-off panels would mean the crew would be isolated from the explosion. It had much stronger armour. I think Leo 2 was 68 tonnes in the form that I was riding on it. But fast, you know, again, fast, probably faster than Leo 1. They had used that 1,500 horsepower that they got out of the even bigger power pack to great effect. So, if I had the choice between Leopard 2 and Challenger 1, then I probably would have gone for one of the later marks of Leopard 2. But, you know, I think when the Cold War was on, the later marks weren't available. They would have been up to the A4 version by the end of the Cold War. And so, again, Challenger 1 would have had the edge of survivability, but certainly it hit just as hard as Chally 1. Leopard 2 had the 120mm smoothbore, the Rheinmetall gun, which, you know, tanks like the Abrams et cetera, they're all running that same gun now. And we know how effective that is as a tank gun. But I think Chally 1 just kept that edge on survivability. The British, they've always put that, their focus on the armour protection. I think that's a good thing. Like when you're facing the Soviet hordes punching across the North German plain and you're a relatively small force compared to them, yeah, you want to be able to survive. You want to be able to take a few hits from that, those 125mm guns that the T-72s were running. There's another facet to that, which I didn't go into, but after the Iraq war, the British captured a number of intact Type 69 twos, which were a Chinese copy of the Russian T-55. And the Australian and British governments did these secret trials at the time on evaluating how effective these export Russian / Chinese armoured vehicles were. And the British did the gunnery trials on it, on the Salisbury Plain. So they fired these things and saw how accurate they were. And we did the automotive trials and, drove them until they broke, basically, and they put them through sensors and got the radar signatures and the thermal signatures and the seismic signatures. And I was actually the driver of a Chinese tank there for a little while. Wow. On this trial. And mate, that thing was a pile of junk. You know, so if it had to come to a stand-up fight between, the T-55, T-62 series of Soviet tanks and Leopard 1 or Chieftain, I've got to say we would have carved them up. We would have absolutely carved them up. They were a pile of junk.
And it's incredible that they're wheeling these things out still in Ukraine.
I know. They're adding armor package to these things, and they are just – I don't know what they're thinking. It's just a waste of good armor. You might as well just take the crews out and shoot them before they get to the Ukraine, because that's – you're doing the same thing effectively,
Yeah,
what a pile of junk. I'll tell you something else just quietly about that Type 69 trial that we did. All the gun kit in it, they'd been retrofitted by the Iraqis with a laser rangefinder and some other, gadgetry to sort of bring them into the 20th century, I think. And guess who supplied it? Vickers. Yeah. So these British Chally 1s in Iraq were firing at their Vickers gun kit, their British gun kit, at Chinese tanks that had been, supplied.
Graded to Vickers sighting.
Yep. I could not believe that. They had American radios, the same that we were using, in them. And this, I'm looking at the laser rangefinder and the gun kit inside, and it's got, proudly supplied by Vickers Armstrong or whoever it was. It was crazy, That arms industry thing is just, it's a vile thing, really.
We never learn. We never learn.
No, we never do. No, you're right.
You sent me a number of photos, and we'll be sharing these in the episode notes. But when you look at the photos, there doesn't seem to be any consistency around uniform.
I know. We look like pirates, I have to say, in the field. That uniform, there's uniform regulations, but what's actually enforced is completely different. And so, during that late Cold War period, I've got another picture. I'll have to find it for you, but it shows a troop just posing for a photo on the back of a tank, and not two of us have anything like identical uniforms on. I remember we used to wear my personal, day-to-day rig in the field was an Australian tank suit, which is, jungle green, GP boots, which are black boots, a green kepi cap, which we would just privately purchase, kind of like the Rhodesian light infantry sort of style cap, and
I had a mouse grey Bundeswehr parka, you know, with the big hood that would go over my combat vehicle crewman helmet and keep me nice and warm. And, you know, so that was my little hybrid outfit. Oh, and my pistol, my personal weapon, I used to carry in a bright burgundy shoulder holster right on the center of my chest that I'd just bought from a leather worker. And he said, I haven't got a black one or a green one. Would this red one do? And I went, yes, it would. So that was my personal.
If you've got a photo of you in that outfit, we definitely want to see that.
I'd love to. Yeah, I'd love to find one. Yeah, I missed that holster. I gave it away when I stopped using a pistol. I gave it to a younger digger, and I wish I'd never had, because it, you know, I know you ask about your favourite souvenir, and that would have been one of mine, keeping the bright red burgundy shoulder holster for my 9mm. Other guys, they would wear the old World War II tank oversuits, you know, that you could convert into a sleeping bag, and they were kind of heavy canvas and they had this monstrous hood in them. But I tried that for a little while, but I soon gave it up because I kept on in the dark. You know, you'd go for we called it a shovel recce, just like the British soldiers. You'd go for a crap in the field. I know you love talking about bodily functions in the field.
We love this sort of detail, Tim. That's right.
Yeah, it's the minutiae, right? Yeah. And I remember crapping in the hood more than once of a tank oversuit, and I thought, nah, never again. So it got relegated to the skip. And other guys, you know, they would wear those, you know, the like a bush ranger. They're called a dryer's a bone over here. You know, they're an oilskin raincoat, like Ned Kelly, the bush ranger, used to wear, you know.
Yeah.
The outlaw look. And so and at night we would just wear balaclavas and beanies, and it was just ridiculous. Like, seriously, we just looked like a bunch of pirates. But you just did what you had to do. You know, we had these for a while we had those American, we called them bush jackets, but they're the American M65 cold weather coats, and they were excellent. You know, and if you could scrounge up the padded liner for them, oh, you'd stay warm. You know, they were a great bit of gear. But yeah, guys, just they lived for comfort.
You know, we talked about these extended exercises, which are sort of probably beyond comprehension to anybody that had served in Europe. But what were you doing for food and rations?
Yeah, okay. We used to eat our resupply system up with, you know, coming up with the fuel and the ammo and all that other stuff. We would get the a combat ration 10 man, which was two slides of just cans, you know, vegetables, and the, you know, we had various sorts of delights, such as I remember one was called meat type 1, and there was another one imaginatively known as meat type 2. A pork and cereal with no, I could never detect any cereal in the pork and cereal, but it was kind of like a dodgy version of Spam. But you'd have little tins of tropicalized butter that wouldn't melt, even if it was on fire, it wouldn't melt. You know, condensed milk, you know. You had enough stuff to eat pretty well out of those ration packs, but we would always supplement them like all soldiers all over the world. We'd buy what we call jack rations. So before you went to the field, your tank would literally look like a delicatessen inside. You know, we would have salamis hanging off the loader's wall, and, you know, strings of onions, and, you know, we would eat as a mainstay. They would always try to keep fresh sliced bread up to us, because the Australian tank crewman lives on what we call jaffles. I don't know if you have them over there. They're like a toasted sandwich in a sandwich press.
Right. Yeah.
And we would have a jaffle iron, which is like a cast iron mold for those toasted sandwiches. And so you would put a bit of meat type 1 and some Tabasco sauce from your jack rations and some eggs. Eggs were always, you know, we would take a lot of eggs with us. And you would fry them up and have this sort of almost cafe-style breakfast, you know, cooked on a single burner gas bottle inside, often resting on the white phosphorus ammunition or the
hash rounds inside the tank while you're cooking. Yeah, and of course you lived on coffee. You know, I picked up a coffee habit in the army, which has never waned. You know, I can drink 10, 15 cups of coffee a day even now, which has got to be good for you, right?
Well, it's certainly keeping you very perky this evening in Australia. So it's working well today.
Yeah, but the food was more than adequate, I guess, the issue stuff. But yeah, we did supplement it. Like I used to love hearing stories. The British guys, particularly, you know, they'd have the bratwurst van, following them around the exercise.
Yeah.
I just dreamed of having a bratty van turn up, but never happened. I remember once on that Kangaroo 89, we were at a roadblock in the middle of nowhere in, you know, the top end of Australia, and these drunken idiots pulled up in a car. You know, they were on their way to a party or something, and they saw this tank parked up on the side of the road, these civilian guys on holiday, and they gave us they said, "Oh, you must be hungry. Here, have an esky full of pies and you know, those meat pies."
Yeah.
And so we ate meat pies as supplementary rations for a couple of days, and they gave us slabs of beer, and then they just waved us goodbye and drove off into the night. It was fantastic, you know.
Wow.
Those little encounters, you know, with the local population, just wonderful.
Wolfgang, that's right. He would have had a challenge finding you in an area the size of Western Europe, I think.
Yeah, true. Although let me just say, we used to have this guy, we called him Milo Bill, and he was a Salvation Army representative, and in the Australian Army, I don't know if they have that in the UK or US forces, but the Salvation Army attaches a guy to each major regiment, and they sort of go where the regiment goes. And this guy, Milo Bill, he would be in this beat up old Series 2A Land Rover, and he'd have his urns of Milo and like a chocolate drink, you know, like Ovaltine.
Right.
He would have urns of hot Milo and cordial, you know, like Kool-Aid, I guess the Americans call it. And he would turn up at places. You go, how the hell did you find us? And how did you get that thing here? You know, he was just, I guess he had that radar for finding guys. And so I remember he would turn up and, he, you know, he's a Salvation Army dude, and he'd always ask, have you written home to your loved ones today? And if you hadn't, he would thrust some writing paper in your hand, and you would have some. He would give you some lollies, and a, you know, if it was hot, you'd walk away with a foam cup of cordial, or if it was cold, a hot cup of Milo. You know, and yeah, so he was. I guess he was the closest thing we had to a Wolfgang, but I would have preferred a Wolfgang, to be honest.
Maybe they're distantly related. You never know.
That's right. Yes.
One thing that we haven't covered that I did want to ask you about the Leopard AS-1 was night fighting capability.
Yep. When they got it in 1977, it was probably one of the best Leopards in the world, I would think. You know, at the time we bought it with, you know, the Belgian Sabka TFCS tank fire control system, so it was all computer. You know, we had a ballistic computer, wind sensors, temperature grain sensors, tank angle sensor. It had a sensor array second to none in the world. But it still had that standard German, for the time, infrared night sight with a infrared/white light spotlight, searchlight. And it never got upgraded in Australian service. So, it didn't stop us from training to operate them in the dark, and it probably would have been okay against an insurgency, but on a conventional battlefield, we would have just been a target not long after it was, you know, everyone else was going passive and later thermal. We were still operating with IR. So as a piece of night fighting equipment, it was very much obsolete even by the time I started operating Leopard. We used to train to use indirect illumination from our reconnaissance troop fire and the Carl Gustav illumination rounds, which were excellent. So they'd turn a night battlefield into a day battlefield. We'd ripple with the searchlights on IR, but you know you were supposed to have had a notional range using the infrared searchlight and night sight of 1200 meters, but no way. That was just a bit of PR spin, I have to say. That you would be lucky if you could see 400 meters at night using infrared. So we, you know, practically didn't use it. We went to a white light and rippled with white light, which again, if you're operating against infantry, is probably fine. It had our white light searchlight had a range of 1500, and it was excellent. So, but on a conventional battlefield, forget it. You just would have been a target. That's one thing that really let Australia down, I think, was never upgrading them to a passive system or a thermal system.
Driving at night then in one of these, particularly the terrain that you're describing, must have been quite hazardous, particularly if you're trying to go at speed still.
Yeah. When I first started, there were no night vision aids. There was a thing called the BM8005, which was a driver's periscope. And the first generation of those that we got, they weren't very good at all. You know, you'd sort of say, is that a road or is it a bottomless creek? You know, you just couldn't really tell. It was that grainy green and black night vision image that you sometimes see on YouTube videos. Mostly it was driving using what we call the Mark One eyeball, just not, you know, your eyes. And it was bloody deadly, to be honest. We actually lost a couple of guys in the regiment in the most horrific circumstances operating at night. You know, the first one, Sergeant Murray, he was killed in a rollover. A tank was travelling at speed at night using Mark One eyeball, and there was a excavation on the side of the road. Tank dropped one track into it and it was flipped on its roof before anyone realised, and he was killed instantly. And there's another soldier, again, just horrific. He was doing that tank was doing a creek crossing at night in a pretty flooded creek, and the tank hit a submerged obstacle and flipped on its roof, and Trooper Patterson, he was killed trapped under the tank in the dark. Not a great thing. And so those two fatalities, they left their DNA in the regiment for years and years and years. And it's probably still lingering with Australian Tank Rimmer. They were pretty nasty incidents. And, you know, I guess lest we forget those two guys, because they paid, you know, they're casualties of the Cold War as much as if it had gone hot. So after those incidents, we started getting one per tank of this thing called the PVS-5s, which were night vision binoculars, and usually the commanders operated them in order to help the drivers. They were pretty good for their time. They were, I think, second generation image intensifying binoculars. But again, you just couldn't see depth with them. All of us can tell stories of close encounters. You know, the amount of times that I've hit things or, you know, thought a road was there, but it was actually a hole using the night vision aids. You know, I've had so many close calls myself, and everyone can tell the same stories that operated the armoured vehicles at that time. Yeah, night fighting was bad. It was really bad. And of course we trained how we were going to fight with those things. So there was, you know, you didn't just turn the headlights on and pretend it wasn't night. We trained hard, and, you know, some of us paid the price, I guess.
And I always think that there are, well, obviously not within the Australian Tank Regiment, these guys aren't forgotten, but I think generally, because people believe that the Cold War wasn't a hot war, that there weren't casualties, and certainly with exercises, it must be in the thousands if you look across all nations that were involved in exercises, even tens of thousands potentially. Absolutely right to remember those guys. Okay, just want to talk about some of the tactics you were using. I mean, you mentioned about the speed of the Leopard being used with its advantage, but how would you be attacking a position? What was the general tactics there?
During the late Cold War, we would often operate the tanks as part of a mechanized combat team, and so we would have mechanized infantry attached to us, mounted in their M113A1s from our sister infantry unit, 5th, 7th Battalion, Royal Australian Regiment. And so one example of an attack would be you would have a troop of tanks off to a flank, pinning the enemy and providing that what we called attack by fire. So you would just be blasting the objective at long range with HESH from the tanks, or screening it with smoke to blind them from our White Phos ammo. And then there'd be other tasks. So you would have the intimate support troop to go in with the infantry and provide that intimate support at close range. Another interesting task at that time was, they called it shock assault, where tanks would just drive straight past the objective, shooting at it on the way past, and just making that objective feel completely worthless as a defensive position, because you would use the speed of the Leopard to just roll past it and then take up a position, another tactical bound forward of it, and then wait for the infantry to finish on that objective. So that shock assault was a particularly Australian way of operating. I think it was probably high risk in a conventional battlefield, but it used the speed and mobility and agility of Leopard to its best advantage, particularly in open terrain. It was pretty awesome to behold, where these tanks would just roll past with absolute impunity, and the objective was neutralised anyway because of the attack by fire and the intimate support fire coming in, and then the infantry just debussing out of the M113s and owning that objective. So, if you could mass your armour enough, that was a pretty effective tactic. Yeah, that was one of the training scenarios we did a lot. Yeah, that sort of shock assault, quick attack off the line of march stuff.
On these exercises, you would have been practicing encrypted communications, but were there particular concerns about signals intelligence and the Soviets picking up anything? Or the Manzurians, sorry, the Manzurian.
Yeah, let's not say the Soviets. Although I think in that case, it was the Soviets. There was always particularly when we went up to places like Shoalwater Bay, which is on the coast up in Queensland there, in central Queensland, always as part of your pre-exercise briefs, that the legendary Soviet trawlers were parked offshore monitoring our comms, and to always keep your radios on the lowest possible power setting, and don't maintain strict radio procedure, et cetera. But I know in more recent times that there's been Chinese trawlers monitoring some of our big exercises, that they've actually got footage of them. But I don't know if we ever saw footage of a Russian trawler, but that was always the urban myth, I guess, like some of those urban myths that came out of tank troops operating in Germany. They would be able to identify individual commanders by the way they speak or operate on the radio and all that sort of stuff. But I don't know how true that was. We used operational codes all the time, and that was the loader's job to cack up you know, grids and times, etc., and then decack them when you came in on the radio. But it was, you know, they were, like I say, they were operational codes. They weren't Bletchley Park stuff. They were just for short-term information.
Hello, I'm Craig Donald from Aberdeen, and I support Cold War Conversations with a monthly donation because it marries interesting historical content with fantastic storytelling. Ian is a great gift as an interviewer. He knows his subject so that the conversations are meaningful, but he also allows guests to tell their own story. Cold War Conversations is part of my weekly routine, and I would urge you to make it part of yours.
Want to be like Craig and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War? As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free. You'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more, or follow the link in the episode information. You were instructed to sort of transmit on the lowest possible power setting.
I remember that was always the word. We had low power and high power, but particularly up in Queensland, you know, where you got, you know, you're talking about VHF communications and line of sight, and like, you know, I guess I was a bit of a naughty boy as a young tank commander. I used to crank it up at maximum power, and because I always wanted to be heard. So I think I was probably a security risk, maybe, but yeah, I used to crank up my radio on the maximum power. Yeah.
It's probably a big file on you, Tim, somewhere.
Yeah, I don't think so, but anyway.
No. I mean, you were talking about some of the exchanges that you had with like the British Army and the US Army, but I think you went on an exchange to the Bundeswehr. Now, this was post-Cold War, but you met an interesting person there.
Yeah, it was post-Cold War. I got posted to the British Army, and then I was able to wangle myself a sort of a separate attachment to the Bundeswehr. I wanted to, you know, because we were still operating Leopard 1 when I was posted overseas, and so I wanted to go and qualify on Leopard 2. I wanted to sort of collect tank qualifications while I was over there. So I challenged, you know, I qualified on Challenger 1. And then while I was there, I said, I want to go and qualify on Leopard 2. And, you know, to my surprise, I was able to. So I got told to report to Rommel Kaserne in Augustdorf, you know, which is a Bundeswehr barracks. And it was their Panzerfahrschule there. And, yeah, great memories of that little course that I did. Got told to report to Hauptmann Steinzig. It's funny, I remember all the names. And so turned up at the guard room, and this German conscript clicked his heels at me and saluted. And I thought, how cool is that? They actually clicked their heels, you know. And, so Hauptmann Steinzig turns up in a Geländewagen and takes me, and he said, so you are the Australian Panzer expert, and you are here to qualify on the Leopard 2, and you will do that, but first we have coffee. And so that was the start of a great relationship I had with those Bundeswehr guys. They were real pros, you know. Just sitting in the CO's office there, drinking coffee, and he said, you must meet Der Speis, you know, and I thought, what the hell is a Speis, you know? And so I'm looking up at the ceiling, wondering if the Speis is what is a Speis? And anyway, this old, you know, I guess the equivalent of an RSM walks in, and, you know, big smile on his face, looked like he'd fought in World War II, this fella, wearing that fantastic German camouflage uniform and their little Africa Corps style caps. And anyway, shook my hand, and, you know, just a nice bunch of guys, real professionals. And so he took me over to my crew on a Leopard 2 and introduced me to those guys. And it was a they'd specially picked a crew that, you know, my German was sort of okay, I guess, you know, for ordering beer and abusing taxi drivers, but not enough for the technical language of a tank course. So they put me in a crew of excellent English speakers. And so we had this sort of a Creole language in our crew, which was great. And one of the guys on the crew was an ex-NVA senior NCO who'd been on T-72s before the wall came down. And Peter, his name was, and a real warrior, like a hard guy, you know, like tough tank soldier, and instant respect for that guy. And we became firm friends pretty quickly. And he would sort of nudge me in the side sometimes, and he would point at his fellow German tank crewmen that were from the Vess, the Vessies, as he called them, and he'd say, "Hey, look how soft they are," you know. And, you know, he goes, what did he say? He said something like, if the Cold War had have ever gone hot, we would have gone through them like shit through a goose, or something like that. I can't remember exactly, but it was, I thought that was such a cool thing to say. He was very confident in the ability of the old National Volks Army, and I really rated him. He was a good soldier. Yeah, he gave me at the end of that trip, he gave me an AK bayonet, you know, an AK-47 bayonet, and it's one of my little personal treasures, that bayonet, you know, because I remember him fondly, you know. That's my little East German army encounter. And he I remember he was quite jaded, and he was very, very jaded that they'd come out of it second best when the wall came down and unification happened. He felt they'd been ripped off. He was quite a senior tank soldier, and he had to virtually start again. But, you know, like, he was a pro, like a proper tank soldier. I liked him, yeah. There was also, they had a little choice, is what I gathered from him, that, you know, he could be unemployed, or he could flick over to the Bundeswehr and start from scratch. And so he chose to start from scratch. But, you know, he was a Stabsfeldwebel by the time I met him, you know, so he'd gone back up. So, but he was quite jaded, you know.
You mentioned the AK bayonet. Have you got any other souvenirs from your Cold War experiences?
Yeah, my favorite souvenir of my Cold War tank journey is, and I'll send you a photo. I've got the secondary sight out of a Leopard AS1, and it hangs above my back deck, above my barbecue. So it's my, you know, at one time that would have been worth so many thousands of dollars. But when the Leopards were getting, you know, they were out of service, replaced by the M1A1, and they were getting dragged out to the range to be shot at as targets, and, you know, some of the guys stripped out some of the parts for souvenirs, and I was lucky enough to pick up a secondary sight. So it's a, you know, it's a couple of metres long, and it hangs from a chain over my barbecue on my back deck, and I look up at it and smile and think of my misspent youth.
And we'll definitely be sharing a photo of that in the episode notes, along with various other interesting photos that Tim's shared with me. Is there any favourite film you've got, a Cold War-themed film, or anything you think is close to representing what some of your experiences were like?
Not really. There's an Australian film based on the Vietnam War, which some people might look. That's not my experience, but it's definitely worth a look. You know, if you want to have a look at Australia's Cold War contribution, probably have a look at a film called Danger Close, which is about an Australian infantry company that were lured into a rubber plantation in Vietnam and fought for their lives. You know, and it's not a bad movie when it comes to accuracy. And it shows the M113s came to the rescue of the infantry that, that night, and, you know, the infantry had lost 17 dead, killed about 245 North Vietnamese soldiers in the dark. And that film's definitely worth a look if you want to have a look at what Australia was doing during the Cold War, I guess.
Okay. No, that's great. I'll add that to the episode notes as well so people can take a look at that.
I just want to thank you and all the listeners. This is a great podcast, Ian, and you know, I do feel like a bit of an imposter, a bit of a second rower in rugby parlance, but, you know, I'm so glad that you thought me worthy of coming on. I worked with so many great guys from so many armies, and the Cold War was a proper war, and I just feel privileged to have served with some of those amazing tank crewmen.
And Tim, you're not an imposter at all. Everybody's story is a different angle or a different view of things, and it's been fascinating talking to you. Until you got in contact with me, I'd not actually thought, well, hang on, what were the Australians doing?
Don't miss the episode extras such as videos, photos and other content. Just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. The Cold War Conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening, and see you next week. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.